8th of a recorded interview with Dr. Samuel Nadelson at his home in Knoxville, Tennessee on February 26, 1998. The interviewers are Dr. Myron Warshaw and James G. Trainum.
So we'll be spending a reasonable amount of time with you. So,
from what I have read, I think I've learned that you were born on February 28, 1909 in Brooklyn, was it?
Yes.
Can you tell me something about your early childhood, your family situation in Brooklyn?
Well, I was a consultant to the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. They had me investigated. And they came to me and said to me, "You have two birthdays, the February 27th, 1909, and February 28th, 1909. I said, "How did you get the first one?" They said, "We got it from your father's prayer book. He used to write in his prayer book the time and date that each child was born. And he had me down for February 27th. Well, it so happened that I must have been a difficult delivery because the nurse who reported my birth at the hospital put down February 28th. So that's how I happened to have two birthdays.
Which one do you celebrate?
I usually put down February 28th because that's on my birth certificate. Now, I never found out why I had two birthdays, so I was never forgotten.
Well, did you attend public schools in Brooklyn?
Yes, I attended the public schools in Brooklyn.
And where did you go to high school? In Brooklyn?
In Brooklyn at the Eastern District High School. It was a Class A high school for gifted children. We had the highest IQ in the school.
What was your father's business?
My father was, as he considered it, the only good business. He was a clock operator. You know what a clock operator was?
No.
That's the way he pronounced it.
No? Tell me.
He would design clothes and cut them out and then baste them together. And his lowest form of, he insulted anybody by calling them a basin puller, someone who just pulled a basin. And there's a famous poem, anti-Semitic poem, that was written by some anti-Semite. He said, "Rosenbaum, he was a fighter, but he fought for a sword he never drew. And he said, 'The hell with fighting, it's no business for a Jew. Butcher, baker, clock operator, those are jobs of great renown. And at the Battle of Manila, he was killing bedbugs on the pillow. Oh, what a fighter was Rosenbaum." But you can see the background of that.
What was your father's name?
My father's name in English was Max, but in Hebrew it was Menachem Mendel.
Oh, man.
And he.
And your mother's name?
My mother's name was Basha Hena. She had no other name except her Hebrew name, mm-hmm. Betty Ann, if you want to call it that.
Was she employed outside the home, or was
no? She had 10 children.
I see. So she had a busy day.
So,
well, when you graduated from high school, what did you do then? Did you go directly to college?
Well, at that time, you had to have an 85 average to get into City College. I had the average, so I went to college. In order to get to college, I had to walk about a mile to the elevator, Lexington Avenue L. Do you remember the Lexington Avenue L?
And you went to
City Hall? They let me out at City Hall. Then I'd walk across the area there and get to a subway and take the Midnight Express. That's what we nicknamed for it was, because it was all blacks. That led me to 137th Street. So you can see it took me a long time to get to work.
Did you go to City College of New York?
Yes.
And did you spend all of your undergraduate college years there?
No. All of my undergraduate college, yes.
Yeah. And did you major in chemistry while you were at City College?
Well, I wasn't there long enough. I did it in about 3.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I majored in physics mostly.
How did you happen to get an interest in science coming out of the
government
background?
I got a fellowship at NYU by the head of the department. And I was recommended by Professor Stevenson, who was a professor at City College in physical chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you went on directly from college to graduate school at NYU?
By the time the graduate school was NYU. By the time I got through NYU, I had published 5 papers, and all of them were blockbusters. I made a lot of people rich.
Including yourself, I hope.
No, not myself. That's the trouble.
Sam, can I ask you, when you were in high school, what got you interested in chemistry and physics?
I was always interested in science. I would look up in the skies and say, Mika Mika Pawa Stella, Miro Quitam Sistam Bella, Spending Zeminus Inero, Alva Wellet Chemikilo. That's shine, shine, little star. I wonder what you are. Up above the world so bright, like a diamond in the sky. You remember that
yes.
Poem? And in those days, there were street lighters who came around and lit the posts, and the city was heated by gas. So if you looked up to the sky, the stars looked very close to you. And I felt an affinity for the stars.
Well, when you were at NYU in graduate school, what led you to pick organic chemistry as your specialization?
Well, the professor I had in organic chemistry was about the best man they had on their faculty, and I wanted to be like him. So I went into organic chemistry, and my first papers were I published how to make rose oil by condensing ethylene oxide with benzene. And I didn't realize that I had a blockbuster. Everybody jumped at that. They were trying to find out some way to make rose oil, which is a phenyl ethyl alcohol. And then I converted it to styrene resins. I dehydrated it, and that was another patent, and I met a patent attorney by the name of Oscar Link, who was a very nice guy, but that's about all. He was not clever. And he was very strict with me about what I wrote, and as a result, his patents were weak and were easily broken. So that I did not get the benefits of any of my patents. I have about 40 or 50 patents. I'll show you my publications in a few minutes.
Okay.
See when we're ready.
When you graduated from NYU with your doctor's degree. Did you get a master's degree on the way, or did you...
I got a master's degree on the way. You know, just as a matter of fact. And they didn't give me a master's degree. They gave me an SCM, which stood for a Master of Science.
Yes.
And then I went on, and I was very stupid in my handling of these patents. You see, I had a rat for a professor. Or when I call say a rat, I mean a rat. He was a low-down character. And
was he the one that had
he
thought was the best one in the department?
Well, I didn't know who was the best one.
Yeah.
I just knew that he was looking for students, and I was a student. So he told me to go. He gave me a problem, and it was to condense ethylene oxide.
Nothing that far.
He told me to make rose oil, which I did. I didn't realize that I had made a very important contribution. These were simple things to me.
When you graduated, you said you already had several publications.
I had about five publications.
Five publications. What was your first employment after getting your doctor's degree?
I went into teaching in high school. I had the misfortune of having a brother who was a history teacher in high school. They told me that the salary was very good and the jobs were very easy, and a lot of people who were, had their PhDs and so on went into the high school teaching. So I went into high school teaching and started teaching chemistry and general science.
It must have been unusual in those days for the high school chemistry teacher to have a doctor's degree.
I don't know if it was unusual. It was not so unusual. Because there were a lot of, I met a lot of people who, as a matter of fact, the objective of many high school, of many PhDs, was to pass the exam and get into the high school system because they paid so well compared to industry.
Oh, really? Quite a difference now, though.
You don't think there's a difference? I don't know about that. I think that the public school system generally pays a little better than, on an average, to the average person, than the college teaching. Teachers are very much underpaid.
Do you remember the name of the high school where you started teaching?
Girls Commercial High School.
Oh. Does that mean you had all girls in your class?
Yes, all girls.
I see.
They were very nice girls, too, very pretty. And they averaged about 15 years of age.
How long did you teach in that high school?
How long did I teach in that high school? I left the high school teaching. I don't remember. I'm trying to figure out when I left it.
Well, what did you go to from the high school? When you left the high school, what was your employment then?
I think I stayed in the high school until I was drafted by National Aeronautics and Space Administration to develop some instruments for them. And I developed some very interesting instruments. For example, I developed a machine which I've got packaged up downstairs. You'll see them this instrument picked up a capillary, washed the capillary through, and then sent the contents down a line. The object, my object was to analyze the blood of astronauts in the weightless atmosphere. And that was the easiest way to do it. So for 15 years, I ran, I had subsequently several jobs in as a clinical chemist. And I tried to define clinical chemistry as an elevated science, but the clinical chemist wouldn't allow himself to be raised to the level of a PhD.
Oh. Well, you started off with a very promising industrial career, I believe.
That's right.
What caused you to shift your interest from industrial chemistry to clinical chemistry?
Because I was not getting any money from the so-called industrial chemistry, and I was not earning a good salary. A teaching fellow got something like $65 a month, and a teacher in high school got about $5,000 a year. So I was perfectly satisfied with my income in high school, and I married a high school teacher. So I was involved in high school teaching, you might say.
And then you became interested in clinical chemistry, I believe.
I invented the term clinical chemistry.
Yes, but
the reason I invented it because the high school I taught at originally from Girls Commercial had an annex, and the annex was a little building that was across the way from the Jewish Hospital in Brooklyn. And I went across the way to the Jewish Hospital in Brooklyn, and I found a very receptive person there. I found a man by the name of Benjamin Kramer. Benjamin Kramer had a master's degree from, I think, Indiana University. And he went on to Johns Hopkins and got his MD degree. And he was the first clinical chemist I'd ever met who was really a clinical chemist. Everyone else, now for example, Sobotka got a degree in Switzerland, I believe. And he got an appointment at in the Bronx at some hospital, and he was paid very well. And when I went to the Jewish Hospital in Brooklyn, the fellow who hired the personnel, I told you, had a master's degree in chemistry, and he hired a chemist from the Rockefeller Institute to do his analyses for him. The chemist from the Rockefeller Institute was Albert E. Sobel, S-O-B-E-L, who became, whom I made famous, you might say, because I was pushing him all the time, and 95% of his contributions were contributions which I had made, and I encouraged him to publish them. And I left Albert E. Sobel to go to I've forgotten exactly where, but
was that when you moved to Rockford Memorial Hospital?
No, I went to Rockford Memorial Hospital by an accident. There was another, see, in my lifetime, I'm a very reasonable person, you might say. Too reasonable, in the sense that I tend to agree with people who don't know their left hand from their right. And every time I would get a consulting job with some industry, this guy Sobel would interpose himself because he had control of the laboratory. And he had no degree at all. But under my influence, he started going to night school at Brooklyn Polytechnic Institute, and I helped him with his master's thesis, and he finally got a master's degree.
He was in charge of the laboratory?
He was in charge of the laboratory. But the person who really was in charge was Benjamin Kramer. And he was really the first clinical chemist that I ever knew. And people knew him from the method of doing calcium determination called the Kramer-Tisdall method. Have you ever heard of that?
I haven't, but I'm sure you have.
But mention why you felt so highly regard for Benjamin Kramer as a clinical chemist. What was he unique? How was he unique?
Well, he was primarily a chemist, and he had gotten into medicine at the Johns Hopkins University. He was hired by Johns Hopkins University as a chemist, and he proceeded to develop this method for calcium. He studied and he's the author of the so-called calcium phosphorus product, the concept that if you multiply the calcium times the phosphorus, see what it was doing. That was a well-known technique in chemistry the number had to be above a certain value in order for a calcification to take place. And he set up experiments in the laboratory. He would raise rats with rickets, and then he would kill them and take their bones and incubate them in little bottles in order to deposit the calcium and determine the level at which it deposits. And he discovered that if you multiply the calcium times the phosphorus level, you got a number, and if you exceeded that number, the bone would calcify. So you would say that he was the first clinical chemist I ever encountered.
Well, this year is the 50th anniversary, I believe, of the American Association of Clinical Chemists, and that's part of the reason for having this interview. And we would like for you to comment about your early involvement with the
Well, I can show you better. I prepared a series of reprints and had them Kinko reprint them so that they would be apparent. And that's the way my wife got killed. She got killed looking for a reprint. She climbed up on she drew out the lowest drawer and stood on that and tried to get something in the back, and she turned around to me and said, I wasn't in back of her, I was sitting on a couch, and she said to me, I'm losing my balance. That's the last words I heard from her. And she fell backwards and smashed her head against I'll show you what happened. And I feel very unhappy about that situation because I feel that I was responsible for her death, see, to a certain extent.
Well, you did what you could at the time.
I didn't do what I could. I could have made a stronger effort. I was sitting on a couch, but I couldn't get up. You see, like you'll see here, I have difficulty getting up unless I have a little support.
Yeah. Well, that's a very sad event, I know.
I feel depressed about that.
I'm sure you do, Dr. Nicholson. But
let's continue the interview upstairs. So, in honor of her memory, because that's what I want.
Do we have a place that we can sit down upstairs?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. You've gotten to Rockford and you're about to tell us about some of your work there?
Yes. I concentrated on microchemistry, and I developed a machine which I have in the basement. I have two copies of it, and I got a phone call from Othmer, O-T-H-M-E-R,
yeah,
who has a museum, and he
and he wanted me to write up an article on rose oil. So I said to him, you write the article and I'll publish it. Because I was sick and tired of this business. Nevertheless, after I did my study, I invented this word, you might say, the immature infant. And this is a copy. And I made about 2,000 copies of this and distributed it at an American Medical Association meeting. And if you look at the beginning of the book, I'll give you a copy of the... This is an enlarged copy of the book. Here.
Thank you.
If you open it up, you'll see it's made large because it was easier for them to copy it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, you'll notice that there were 25 physicians who were involved. And the principle I established was this, that with chemistry, you could analyze a patient's blood or some other tissue and find out what his problem was and also what the solution is. And that's essentially what this immature infant. I said, if we read what I say in here, an immature infant is an infant who, you'll see first of all on the front page, there are 25 physicians engaged in this project, and I encouraged them, and each of them gave me at least one patient to work with. And the general attitude was, when you take the book home, you will see that what the current thought was at that time. Here's a copy for you.
I got one. You gave me. Thank you.
Okay. If you have a child, I was up against a tough competition. There was a fellow by the name of Smith, who was at Harvard, who had written a book on the premature infant, in which he said that if an infant weighs less than 1 pound, leave him alone for 24 hours. And what I show in this, one of the first experiments I did was to test his theory. I weighed a child and I saw how much fluid he lost in 24 hours. And then I tried to bring him back with fluids and I was unsuccessful. So I actually killed that child so as to prove my theory that the present situation which they used was unsatisfactory. And for the next 5 or 6 years, I concentrated on developing a machine that would analyze the blood of infants and which was good for space. I used space money, space travel money, to do it. And I've got the machines, two of them, down in the basement. I used them for 15 years in the routine laboratory. And then when I moved out, my successor was, I was pushed out by a pathologist. General rule was this. They would let you work until you were ready for retirement, and then they would say, they would hold an affair in your honor in which they would give you all kinds of awards like these plaques, and then they would tell you, get the hell out of here, which was a polite way of, this was a routine. I've got a number of plaques all over the place. If you turn around and look up there, you see the 29th annual meeting of clinical chemistry was I chaired that meeting, and some photographer put together that with all his pictures and put me in the center and made that picture. And this is my job. I came to Rockford. I made a terrible blunder. I made a blunder because I came where a son of mine, my oldest son, had now reached maturity. When he was about 12 or 14 years